In a world of never-ending buzzing and alerts, new research suggests that in order to get the full benefits of nature, leave your devices at home. Plus, are self-driving cars the future of transportation? Lots of people think so, including Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi. Here he is on the Today Show.
We're absolutely committed to self-driving cars. This is an important technology. Ultimately, self-driving cars will be safer than humans.
We'll hear about what's next for automated cars and whether they could actually translate into more manufacturing jobs here in Illinois. But first, more than 100 immigrant children and teens separated from their parents at the border have been held in Chicago area shelters this year. We're talking to ProPublica Illinois about their recent investigation into possible incidents of abuse and negligence at those shelters. It's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up this hour, we're going to be talking about self-driving cars. Would you be comfortable riding inside one or sharing the road with one? We're going to get to that later in the hour, and we'd love to hear from you on that topic. You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet your thoughts to 21STShow. We're also going to be talking about how to take a break from all the news and your devices. By being in nature, have you ever heard of forest therapy? That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. But first, today we wanted to spend some time talking about Illinois and the immigrant children who have been detained here. There were at least 2,551 immigrant children in the United States who were separated from their parents because of the Trump administration's zero-tolerance border policy. Now that a federal judge has ordered the reunification of these families, the Trump administration has until Wednesday to turn over a list of all parents who are, quote, ineligible for reunification. Here in Illinois, more than 100 immigrant children and teens separated from their parents at the border have been held in Chicago area shelters this year. By last week, all but 17 of those children here in Illinois were reunited with their parents. But the spotlight on family separation has also drawn attention to the living conditions for all the children occupying these shelters. Senator Dick Durbin has called for an investigation into one Illinois facility after allegations of abuse were first reported by the Washington Post a few weeks ago, and the U.S. Health and Human Services Department and Illinois Department of Children and Family Services are investigating. ProPublica Illinois has been looking into what we know and don't know about all of these Chicago area children's shelters. And on the line with me more now to talk more about their reporting are ProPublica Illinois reporters Jody Cohen and Dua Eldeeb. Jody, Dua, thanks for being with me. Welcome to the 21st.
Thanks for having us.
I wanted to start by asking you all, has the Trump administration's decision to separate children from their families, is that you think why we're looking at all of these shelters and brought so much of this more into the limelight, Jody?
I do think that's the case. There have been children, unaccompanied minors who've crossed the border for decades who've been housed in Illinois shelters and obviously elsewhere across the country. But the Trump administration's zero-tolerance crackdown definitely put this in the spotlight as children were separated from their parents and put into many of the same shelters and facilities where minors have been living for years.
And how many shelters are there in Illinois?
So there are 11 shelters, and five of those are in the city of Chicago. The rest are in the suburbs. All but two of them are run by Heartland, and the other two are run by Maryville Academy, a Catholic child welfare group.
And how did you all find out? How did you all find out this information?
So we were able to find out information about the different sites by filing various public records requests through the Freedom of Information Act, both from, we filed requests to the Department of Children and Family Services, and as well as, records from the police and the fire marshal and other agencies that have some role in some oversight role. And we also, talked to employees and former employees and children who have lived there to get more information. So it was a combination of interviews and talking with people and getting as much information as we could from records.
And we're going to talk about that in a minute, a little bit more about how the city of Chicago is moving to take some action to have more information about these shelters made public. It sounds like this is very murky, though, in terms of trying to find out who's in charge of these shelters. And then ultimately, also, I wonder if you can explain who has oversight. Is this DCFS? Is this the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services? How does that work?
Well, that's a great question. So because these are federally contracted shelters, so their contract is with the federal government, not with the state of Illinois, DCFS goes in primarily just to license these shelters. So they go in, they've got scheduled visits once a year, where they go in, they kind of check off the list of standards and codes. So where is their hand washing station? You know, do the employees, are they up to code on their immunizations and, you know, things of that nature. So it's really primarily a licensing visit. So they're not really there to check on the well-being of the kids. So that is done through the federal government. The problem that we face is we have filed requests with the federal government asking for those monitoring reports, asking for any records that would help us understand better what role they are playing in terms of oversight, how often they're at these shelters, what they're looking at, and we have not received a response yet.
And Jody, can you just explain how this contract works? So nonprofits, in this case, Heartland Alliance, has a contract with the federal government to run these shelters, so they're paid by the federal government?
Yes, you're exactly right. So there are for-profit and nonprofit organizations that contract with the federal government and the Office of Refugee Resettlement, and that's a specific agency. And so Heartland has these federal contracts, and the contracts are to fund the different sites that house unaccompanied minors and more recently separated children.
And so how many children are in, you mentioned there were 11 area shelters. Do we know how many children are in all of these shelters right now?
So, you know, the children cycle in and out, and throughout the year, you know, we've heard that more than 3,000 children will come through Chicago at these shelters. And, you know, Jody had mentioned the contracts with the federal government. If you're talking about how much money, Heartland gets, Heartland has received more than $180 million in federal funding since FY 2013, specifically for these programs, for these children. And, you know, when you look at that in context at the national level, it's the fourth highest amount of any organization that houses these unaccompanied minors, and it's more than any organization outside of Texas.
And you mentioned that there were for-profit and not-for-profit organizations that are running this. Heartland Alliance is a not-for-profit, correct?
It is, yes. Heartland, both Heartland and Maryville are nonprofits.
Jody, I think you mentioned that
question,
you all... Go ahead, Jody.
I was going to say your question about the numbers is an interesting one because it should be a very simple answer, right? You should be able to ask Heartland how many children are in your care right now and you would get a number back. But they will not or have not recently answered that question, saying that the Office of Refugee Resettlement is restricting what they can say, what kind of information they can provide. So in terms of total numbers, in the last number they gave was in June when they said there were 451 children in their care, about 75 of whom had been separated from their families. Last week they said all but 17 of those children had been reunited, but did not provide a total number of children in their care.
Because obviously, presumably, there are other unaccompanied minors who came, and that was what the bulk of, I know we've actually had the Heartland Alliance on the program in the past, and they've said that's been the bulk of children who they're looking after as well, right, Jody?
Yes, exactly. That is the bulk of the children they look after.
And Jody, you mentioned that you all have been talking to a few of the residents of these facilities. What have they said to you about the living conditions of what these kids are living with?
You know, they've described what it's like to live there. They They go to school. They have classes for 6 hours a day. There's recreation time. They have meals together. They sleep, depending on the facility, you know, several children in a room in bunk beds. One of them, you can kind of see the bunk beds from the street, actually. Recently, one of our colleagues spoke to an 11-year-old who had been separated from his family and was living in one of the Heartland sites. And he described some problems, saying that if, you know, he was told if he didn't abide by the rules, it would threaten his immigration case. He would be there longer. There has been, you know, there was one negligence lawsuit filed against Heartland, but by that same boy, his mom in the lawsuit alleged that there were older children there who were bullying him and the staff wasn't doing enough. And then at one point, one of the older boys tripped him and he fell into a bed and required staples in his head.
And so, as Jody's mentioning, there have been a few lawsuits. The Washington Post first reported on these allegations at the beginning. I think it was a couple of weeks ago. What are some of the allegations? And I guess it's against Heartland Alliance, and most of them revolve around one facility, correct?
So there's Casa Guadalupe is the facility that's really been in the news lately, and that's located in Des Plaines. And that is where the 11-year-old boy that Jody was talking about was the lawsuit was alleging that he was injured there. And so, you know, like we said, there's 11 of these shelters total. And the Casa Guadalupe is actually, you know, it's in Des Plaines, but it's a cluster of cottages there that they refer to as Casa Guadalupe.
Heartland put out a statement last week saying that they have heard allegations about their program. They are troubling. They said they do not reflect their values or the quality of care that we strive to provide. They said upon learning about this, they self-reported their concerns to the Office of Refugee Resettlement and DCFS. Were you all able to speak to Heartland for your reporting? What response did you get from them about particularly Casa Guadalupe, but other incidents as well? Jody?
So we did speak with Heartland, you know, by phone and through email answers, and this has been a really, you know, interesting time for them because they feel strongly against the zero tolerance policy that led to the separation of children, yet they are caring for these children. So this has been really a tricky time for them. They do say that they take all the allegations seriously. They're investigating, that they, you know, will not tolerate any behavior that they, as far as the negligence lawsuit, they said that they have not been able to substantiate that. But they are looking into every report that they get. That's what they told us.
This past week,
and Nyla,
go ahead, Dua.
Sorry, you know, you mentioned, you know, DCFS. So, as I said, their primary role is licensing. But because they are the state agency that is charged with investigating allegations of abuse or neglect, regardless of whether or not the child is in DCFS custody, they have also opened an investigation following, you know, these allegations. And in our reporting, we found that DCFS has also cited Heartland in previous years. So in 2015, Heartland was cited for a supervision violation when an employee there was accused of having an inappropriate relationship with a child at the shelter in Bronzeville. DCFS ultimately concluded that that allegation was unfounded, but Heartland did end up firing that employee. And then the following year at a different location, this is actually in the Casa Guadalupe location, DCFS found that children there had engaged in sexual activity, and they had cited DCFS again for inadequate supervision.
And I wanted to just end by asking you all, the Chicago City Council voted to have city officials periodically inspect the facilities, saying they're concerned, to your point, Dua, that state and federal officials are not doing enough. They passed an ordinance that requires Heartland to disclose to city officials a little bit more about the facilities. And I just wanted to ask you about the politics of this, because we heard sort of back and forth, as Jody, as you were saying, in Chicago City Council, of people defending Heartland, people saying, other aldermen saying that, no, we need to hold them accountable. And I wonder how much you find that this issue has been, when it comes to Chicago City Council, it has this become so politicized. Jody?
So, yes, it's, I mean, like everything else, there's, you know, you can politicize anything. And Alderman Burke has come out firing on this issue, and his, you know, his seat is up for re-election. But the city council did vote last week to have city inspectors from building, health, and fire departments periodically inspect the Heartland sites, as you said. And also, some of the aldermen were really bothered by the fact that they had no idea that the Heartland facilities were in their wards. They were in their neighborhoods and were really troubled by that. And that's why they demanded to know the addresses.
We have just a minute, less than a minute left, but Dua, I think the most important question is, in the end, is it clear who's accountable for these children?
I don't think it is clear. You know, you've got Heartland saying, well, we're being monitored by DCFS and being monitored by the federal government, and you've got DCFS saying, well, our primary role is really just licensing, and then you've got the public and some of our elected officials saying, we want to be able to know what's happening inside, and Heartland saying, well, you know, our hands are tied. The federal government is not allowing us to release this information. So I think what this really shows is, you know, the additional public scrutiny is needed, and that we really need to know what's happening inside these shelters.
Lots of questions still remaining. I want to thank Dua El-Deeb with ProPublica Illinois, along with Jody Cohen, for joining us. We'll tweet out their reporting on this as well. Thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, you might be listening to this show while driving. Well, imagine if that car was driving itself. That future might not be too far off. Tech corporations like Uber and Google have made it no secret that self-driving cars are a big priority for them. And that shift could change local economies as well. Here in Illinois, two companies have been founded just in the last 10 years that make products that relate to self-driving cars. What do you think? Would you use a self-driving car in your day-to-day life, or would you feel comfortable sharing the road with us? Spencer just said on Twitter, by the way, you can tweet to us at 21STShow. I live in a rural area in central Illinois and am always driving between small towns for work. That constant back and forth means I spend a lot of my working day just driving. I look forward to using my drives to write emails and return phone calls throughout the day. What do you think? How do you feel about maybe sharing the road one day with a self-driving car? You can give us a call at 1-800-222-9455. You can keep those tweets coming to 21STShow. Joining us now to talk about this is Wolfgang Juchmann. He's Vice President of Worldwide Sales and Business Development with Autonomous Stuff. That's a company based in Morton. Here with me in studio here in Urbana is Gare Delarude, a professor of mechanical science and engineering at the University of Illinois. But first, we're going to start with Ryan Denham with our partner station WGLT in Bloomington Normal. He's been reporting on one of the automated vehicle companies that's recently set up a factory in Normal. That's a company called Rivian. Hi, Ryan. Welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So we've talked a little bit about Rivian in the past. They're a company based in Michigan. They've recently set up a factory in Normal. Our Bloomington Normal listeners will know a lot about this, where the Mitsubishi plant used to be. What's going on with Rivian right now in the factory, Ryan?
Sure. So Mitsubishi closed down operations at that manufacturing plant in Normal in about 2015. Toward the end of 2016, beginning of 2017 is when Rivian came in and acquired the plant and everything inside of it for like $16 million. So Rivian is kind of the current incarnation of this company. It's an electric vehicle startup with some autonomous driving components to it. The company's been around for in some incarnation since about 2009 and based in different states, Florida, Michigan, and now planning to make a bunch of electric vehicles right down the road in Normal.
And what's the time frame for that?
Production would begin next year, and it would be for sale in 2020.
And how many folks have they hired, Ryan?
They have about 50 employees, 50 to 60 employees here in Normal, and a few hundred more in different locations in California, northern and southern, as well as outside of Detroit in Michigan.
And I know, Ryan, even back when April, when we were in Bloomington Normal doing some shows from there, we had a hard time getting a hold of the folks at Rivian. Have they opened up a little bit more in terms of talking to folks in the community about what they're doing and their plans?
Yes, actually. It was a source of humor and pain sometimes as a reporter trying to get information out of Rivian early on. But in about mid-May is really when they opened up. It was a pretty noticeable shift in their PR marketing strategy. They exited what they had called like deep stealth mode, which is a very cool name for what they were doing, which was just not talking. And essentially what happened in mid-May is they made a bunch of disclosures in media interviews with us and other outlets saying that they were going to be revealing their first two vehicles, a pickup and an SUV, at the LA Auto Show this coming fall. They talked about the international money that was behind the company, talked about how much the vehicles would cost and how fast they would go. And then the company's CEO, a guy named RJ Scaringe, he's lined up to speak at a big community event here in Bloomington Normal in November, I think it is, or October. So certainly a stepping out moment for those guys.
And I should note to our audience that we did invite Rivian to join our conversation. They weren't able to join us due to scheduling. Ryan, how much are these cars going to cost? What did they say?
Well, I think the low end is starting at least at $50,000, which, I mean, for a nice pickup truck, even a non-electric one, is not a crazy figure, but, you know, certainly not an economy vehicle.
Right, but that's much less than, I thought it was going to be. That's Ryan Denham, who's a reporter with WGLT in Bloomington Normal, giving us a little sense of at least what's happening with Rivian. Ryan, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
I mentioned that Garrett Delarude is also with us. He's a professor of mechanical science and engineering at the University of Illinois. He also teaches in computer science and electrical engineering. Garrett, as we were hearing about that one company, Rivian, that set up this factory for automated cars in Normal, I wondered if we could zoom out for a minute and if you could explain to us what the basic technology is behind automated vehicles and how they work.
Pleasure to be on. So you can think about there's being sort of three basic components to the car. I mean, it's more complicated than that, obviously, but you can think about the actual physical vehicle itself, which is, you know, what you sit in, the steering mechanism, the acceleration mechanism. And you can think about the sensing system, which kind of gives you information about the world around you. And, you know, again, this is kind of a physical part of the vehicle. And then it's the algorithms inside the vehicle that sort of make the decisions about, you know, how to stay in the lane. Is there an obstacle in the way? Is there a dangerous situation? And so it's the overall vehicle is sort of a complex interplay sort of between sort of the cyber world and the physical world. And, you know, a lot of the effort right now is being put into trying to understand the dynamics of the overall system and develop the algorithms that drive the car. Yeah.
And Garrett, you're describing some of this. Certainly, my car does a lot of this already. My car tells me when I shouldn't change lanes because it senses that there's another car there. How much of our smart cars or our vehicles are already doing a lot of this for us already?
Well, they have some of the components. So they'll warn you about things, but they're not actually taking action. So they still have a human that can sort of make judgments in the loop. But it's sort of closing that loop and sort of saying, you know, we're not going to have a human to make any decisions. We're going to have everything that could possibly happen be automated. I think that's the big challenge.
And when we're talking about automated things, Wolfgang Juchmann is also on the line with us. He's with a company called Autonomous Stuff. They're based in Morton. Wolfgang, I understand you all provide components and engineering services for autonomous products. Is that mainly for vehicles or is that for other things?
Thanks a lot for having me on the show, by the way. Yes. So this is mainly for vehicles at the moment, but we also address other markets like the robotics, the maritime, universities, the military has some self-driving vehicles or self-driving things, the mining sector. There's actually already lots of self-driving vehicles in the mining industry, in the mines, in the closed circuit that are already happening now. So if you ask me, when is autonomous driving happening, that's already happening now. Yeah. So we work with all of those different industries.
And do you, I wonder, it sounds like, I mean, when we think about the auto supply chain, of when we think about car manufacturing, and particularly in Illinois, but throughout the Midwest, how many companies there are that help supply that, is that kind of, that sounds like that's something that you all do for automated industries. Am I understanding you correctly?
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, where we are is essentially be ahead of these companies, be on the, what we sometimes call the bleeding edge of technology, where people are trying to figure something out. And a lot of the larger companies, they can't move as fast as we can move as a small agile company in Illinois, where we provide these services, these products, these engineering services, the software solutions, so that we can save these larger companies time. So when they want to go to their project and they want to implement what they want to do, we already give them the tools so they can start working with their development on day one.
And when we're thinking about the technology of this scare, I wonder, we've been focusing on self-driving cars. Wolfgang mentioned the self-driving vehicles that are already happening, for example, in the mining industry. How much of an overlap are, when we're thinking about autonomous technology, are we already seeing, whether we're talking about smartphones or other things, how much has this field grown?
Well, so there's a big overlap between, say, mining vehicles and driving sort of passenger cars. I think the big difference is safety aspects. I mean, the sorts of unexpected events that can happen in a mine are the set is a lot smaller than could happen out in New York
incident.
City or Chicago. Yes. So you know, that's where big challenge is. In terms of the technology, a lot of the things that sort of all the miniaturization and everything that's gone to our smartphones, that's kind of the same technology that's making many of the things with autonomous vehicles possible. It's the same type of hardware and software.
And Gere, have you ever ridden a self-driving car before?
You know, I have. I called an Uber in Pittsburgh not so long ago, and it picked me up. It had two test pilots in the front, but I did ride in it, yeah.
And did you know that it was going to be self-driving when
I knew as soon as I called it, but not before. Yeah, so it was serendipitous. Yeah.
And what was that like?
It was pretty cool. I was at a conference, cyber physical systems conference, which is sort of the science of this general area. And I was pretty pleased. And I have a video of it. They Uber provided sort of a video feed for it. And it felt like a very conservative driver, let's just say. That's how it felt.
And when we're thinking about this, when we're thinking about self-driving cars on the road, what are things that you, in terms of when we think about the technology, what are the things that are, you think the technology exists right now for doing very well versus not so well?
So driving and, you know, lane keeping, following the road, you know, those kinds of mundane things that we do, it can do that very well. The problem is when something, an emergency situation occurs, the car has to kind of go into what we call the nonlinear regime. We have to do something very aggressively. The sort of the models that the algorithms are using are not, you know, capable yet to handle those kind of situations typically.
And so for people who
it's a big challenge.
Well, it's a big challenge, and I wonder if even more of the challenge is, frankly, that there's going to be a period of time when people are going to be sharing the road with self-driving cars.
You know, that's another element of uncertainty. Yeah. So I mean, that's a huge, huge element. You don't know what people are going to do. And, you know, I think when we drive, we, you know, recognize a lot of human cues when we drive, if not just looking at the other driver and so on. So, yeah, I mean, these are the huge challenges right now.
I'm speaking with Geir Delarude, who's a professor in mechanical science and engineering at the University of Illinois. Wolfgang Juchmann is also on the line with us. He's vice president of worldwide sales and business development for the Morton-based Autonomous Stuff. Wolfgang, I wonder what your thoughts are on self-driving cars, and particularly the safety and what Geir has been talking about, the sort of unpredictable element where I imagine a time in the foreseeable future where self-driving cars will have to share the road with people driving cars.
Yeah, I can't agree more with him. The mundane task of self-driving, staying in the lanes, that is solved. It's the extreme cases that still need to be solved. So it's, as one says, the 80% are solved, but the last 20% are probably the more difficult ones that still need to be solved. But then there's a whole other element that I think you touched on slightly is the acceptance by the population. Do people actually want to drive in a self-driving car? Do they feel comfortable or do they not feel comfortable? I'm originally from Germany, where people still prefer stick shifting over automated shifting. So how can you imagine that they would trust a self-driving car? But on the other side, I'm also stuck in traffic every day, and I live in Silicon Valley, and I would love to do emails while I drive, similar to your Twitter reader that sent that message. I mean, it would be so great if I could use that time more useful than following the car in front of me and paying attention. So I think that's also, when are people ready to actually accept and embrace this technology?
And right. And I also, as we're talking about this, Wolfgang, also, there's also kind of the fun aspect of driving a car, too, right? You mentioned Germany. I'm thinking of the Autobahn. How many people enjoy driving? That's another aspect we haven't talked about as well, right?
Yes, and I think that's what some people think. They're in the self-driving car, so they can't drive themselves anymore. And that's absolutely, I don't think that's necessarily true. It's a little bit like your cruise control, adaptive cruise control. When you leave your house in the morning, in your driveway, in the neighborhood, you probably drive yourself. When you get on the freeway, it starts getting boring and put your speed control on, your cruise control on, and let the car control the speed. And I think this would be similar to self-driving, where there's certain aspects where you would still drive yourself, the more dangerous or more difficult situations. But then when it becomes, or the more fun situations, like driving on Highway 1 on a sporty, curvy road next to the ocean. But then when it becomes boring, when you're stuck in traffic, when it's just very mundane on Highway 5 from San Francisco to LA or something like that, or on your way to Chicago, that's when you let the car take over and you can actually relax and do other things.
So Wolfgang, you're based in the Bay Area. I just wanted to ask you about Autonomous Stuff is based in Morton. That's where your CEO is from. Does the company plan to keep its operations in Illinois?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, the reason we're in Illinois is because Bobby, who's the CEO of our company, who founded it in 2010, he was born there. He started developing it there. And what he discovered is actually that the people that work for him, including myself, but the people, especially the local people in Morton, Illinois, they're very loyal, very hardworking. We have a lot of demanding customers that need some very fast. There's no hesitation to jump in from any of them to come on a weekend day to get something fixed that a customer needs, and that's what we rely on. And then, of course, there's the whole ecosystem around it. There's the University of Illinois Champaign. There's other companies that have a lot of tech talent. So, So Morton is actually not a bad location to work in, where you don't have that big competition that you might have in Silicon Valley.
And Garrett, just as we end here, I just wonder about the economic implications for Illinois. Is this something, we've talked about Rivian, we've talked about Autonomous Stuff. Is this something where you could foresee more of this becoming a part of Illinois' economy in the future?
I think so. There's tremendous opportunity here. I think, given the rural nature of a lot of the state, I think there's a lot of opportunity for, uptake, too, in terms of, users, as Wolfgang mentions, folks having to drive, long distances in the country and so on, in the countryside and so on is a great use case for these kinds of cars and so on. So I think it could have a huge boost. Yeah.
Well, we will look out for more news from Rivian. As we heard at the beginning of this conversation, we'll start seeing some test vehicles and some vehicles that will be for sale, maybe even as soon as in the next couple of months. But right now, I just want to thank Geir Delarude, who teaches in mechanical science and engineering, is his appointment at the University of Illinois. He also works with electrical engineering and computer science. I also want to thank Wolfgang Juchmann with Autonomous Stuff, a Morton, Illinois company. Geir, Wolfgang, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're going to continue our technology conversation, but from a little bit of a different angle about what you should do with your devices when you're taking a break and wanting to be outside in nature. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. It's becoming increasingly hard to unplug. You know what I mean. You've got cell phones and tablets, social media and games, and of course, the news. So today we're going to talk about taking a break from all of that by stepping outside and getting some fresh air. It seems logical that if you really want to take a break, you should leave your devices behind. But now we've got some scientific research that backs up that idea. Illinois landscape architect Bill Sullivan was one of the people behind that research. He's also head of the Department of Landscape Architecture at the U of I. He's with me now at WILL in our studios here. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the 21st.
Nyla, it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Also joining us from the Morton Arboretum in Lisle is Brenda Spitzer, who's a forest therapy guide. Hi, Brenda. Thanks for joining us.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks for having me here.
Professor Sullivan, before we get to your research, what do we know about the benefits of nature for our brains?
Well, over the past 30 years or so, there's been a lot of research that's been conducted in universities around the world that shows that having regular contact with green spaces, even urban green spaces, can have really important impacts for our capacity to recover from mental fatigue, to recover from stress. Having a nature-rich neighborhood means that people are outside more often, and that leads to stronger social ties with neighbors. Recent studies show that there are implications for our immune system. And there's even work that shows that teenagers that are associated or that have greater contact with green spaces are in a better mood.
And Brenda, when you think about other, as Bill's talking about our mood, other aspects, I wonder what else you wanted to add in terms of the benefits you see for folks who are doing, and we're going to get into what your forest therapy is in a minute, but just the people who are doing work with you at the Morton Arboretum.
Well, we experience a lot of psychological benefits, such as, you know, increased sense of well-being, relaxation, positive impact on depression. And time that people spend in the forest on my walks can also leave them feeling more calm, focused, more creative. Here at the Arboretum, we offer many nature-based educational programs to help people of all ages connect with and appreciate trees and nature.
And Bill, I wonder what happens when we introduce technology into these conversations. When we're thinking about technology and the outdoors, say we want to go for, I think lots of people, when they're going for a bike ride or even a walk, they're bringing their technology with them because they're listening to music.
I think if you're listening to music, you're probably getting some of the benefits of being in a green space. But if you're engaging in social media, if you're watching YouTube, listening to podcasts is interesting. I'm not sure about that.
Okay,
I think we need to explore that possibility.
And how did you conduct your research? So you studied a concept. Is it called attention restoration therapy? Can you explain what that means?
It's called attention restoration theory. And what it says is that it recognizes that we have two ways of attending to things in the world. Some things require no effort to pay attention to. Think of watching the campfire or a fire in the fireplace or a waterfall or a baby. In fact, there's some things that are really difficult not to pay attention to. If you see a toddler walking towards the staircase, for instance, or someone's telling a story next to you while you're trying to work and you hear this story about somebody being cheated, it's really hard not to have your attention focused on that story. Or wild animals. You see a deer or a fox outside your home and it's all of a sudden you're just totally focused on them. And that kind of attending to things that are softly fascinating, requires no effort on your part. there's whole other category of things that are really important to us that we pay attention, that we focus our attention on, that we consciously decide to attend to. Preparing for an interview, for instance, or doing the work that's associated with much of what we do in society today, schoolwork, teaching, grading, writing proposals, that kind of stuff.
So how did you set up this study? What did you ask your study participants to do to measure how distracted we really can get?
Yeah, so we asked this question. We know from previous research that being in a green space allows you to recover from mental fatigue faster than if you were in a built space. And we also wondered whether or not if you had your cell phone or your laptop with you, does that interfere with the process of recovering from mental fatigue? So we set up this very simple experiment in which we had people on our campus here randomly assigned to four different conditions: a green space or a barren space, and within those two spaces, either to use or not use their laptop. And we simply had this question: if we get these people mentally fatigued and give them a break in the kind of space they're randomly assigned to, will they recover from the mental fatigue faster in one space or another? And that's what we did.
And what did you find out?
Well, we found out that if you make people mentally fatigued and then you measure their capacity to pay attention, then you give them a 10-minute or 15-minute break in one of these four kinds of spaces, then you come back and you measure their attention again, that the only space in which they were randomly assigned that people actually improved their attentional functioning was the green space in which they did not use their laptop. Another way to say this is, if you go to a green space or a barren space and you use your laptop, it was like that 15-minute break didn't occur at all.
So it didn't even make it really was almost useless in terms of taking a break if you had a laptop with you.
If in terms of recovering from mental fatigue, it was worthless.
Brenda, does this surprise you?
No, it does not. On a forest therapy walk, for example, the objective of the walk is to give participants an opportunity to take a break from technology and the stresses of the daily life, 24-hour news cycle, and to just slow down and appreciate the details in nature that can only be noticed when they're moving very slowly through it. And the key to forest therapy is not to cover a lot of miles, but to just walk through nature with intention and take it all in.
So can you tell us what you help people do as a forest therapy guide at the Morton Arboretum, Brenda?
I sure can. At the Morton Arboretum, we have walks all year long for forest therapy. And on my walks, I always start out by having my participants all just get in touch with their senses and what they're noticing. I suggest they disconnect from their technology and put their to-do lists aside and think of our time together as time for them. And then I have them, you know, focus on the sense of touch and hearing and smell and just notice what it's like to be in the moment they're in that place. And after they've gotten in touch with their senses, what I have them do is just begin to move slowly along the trail. And I offer them a series of invitations, which are really just suggestions of how to connect with the natural world using their senses. And then periodically along the trail, we'll also stop and gather up and have an opportunity to share what we're noticing. And when we do share what we're noticing along the trail, it expands everyone's awareness.
And how long do you normally do these walks for, Brenda?
The average walk is 3 hours in length, and we move very slowly because it covers just 1/4 to 1/2 mile. And this gives us lots of opportunity to notice details.
And Brenda, why are some reasons why folks are coming to you and people are telling you they're seeking out these forest therapy guided walks that you've been doing?
Well, people will come to me and tell me that, you know, they've been feeling so stressed because of the fast pace they move at, multitasking, maybe being stuck in traffic, and they just want a little escape from that, just like a little mental vacation, let's call it, where they can just take some time and relax and be in nature and use their senses.
We're talking,
so I think
yeah.
For,
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Brenda.
For people, it's just a real break for people to be able to do that, because, you know, sometimes it's hard to give ourselves permission to slow down and to just take some time for ourselves. And so one of the reasons I think a lot of people sign up for the walks, it gives them that permission and that opportunity.
And I imagine devices are not allowed on these walks, are they, Brenda?
They are not. Now, you know, sometimes people need to have a device with them, but I always suggest that at the very least they silence their devices. Sometimes, you know, maybe they have small children at home and they need to be able to be in touch. So as long as they silence their device, that helps quite a bit. If they can leave it in the car or turn it off, that's even better.
We're talking about nature and technology with Brenda Spitzer. She's been sharing her work as a forest therapy guide at the Morton Arboretum. Bill Sullivan's also in studio with me here in Urbana talking about his research. And Bill, when you look at the notion of technology and being outside, I wonder if you studied at all the effects of people with their phones and taking pictures, because I wonder how many people now in sort of our Instagram world are so focused on taking a picture that they're not maybe noticing what's actually, they're not experiencing things.
That's a very interesting question, Nyla, and it's something that we haven't studied yet, and, you know, that's a good idea. Maybe I'll write that down and see if we can include that in one of the upcoming studies. I think if you're focusing on the landscape in a way that captures your attention, there's probably a benefit to it. If you're focused on the composition of the picture or some distracting elements that you're trying to solve a problem, to the extent that you're solving a problem, suggests that you wouldn't be getting the benefits of being in a green space. But if you're actually kind of enjoying, if you're taking a picture of the campfire and you're just kind of joyfully taking the snapshot, you're probably doing okay.
And when we're thinking about the length of these, Brenda was mentioning her forest therapy walks are about 3 hours long. When we're thinking about the idea of taking a break, I don't know if we have a sense of how long we need to be to take a break to recharge. You tested 15 minutes. I don't know if that was for the purposes of your studies. Do you think there's a specific amount of time that you think is at least a minimum that people should be doing?
I'm sure that a 3-hour walk in the Morton Arboretum is a wonderful experience, but the research suggests that you don't need nearly that long of an exposure to have a measurable difference. We did a study with high school students a couple of years ago in which a 10-minute break in a green space had a significant implications for their capacity to pay attention. People recover from stress in 5 to 6 minutes being in or having a view to a green space. So you don't even have to be in the green space, just a view to a green space. And we've got some studies that suggest even a short view of a few seconds can have an impact on your on physiological stress, kind of calm your heart rate, make you feel a little less stressed.
And Bill, as a landscape architect, I wonder how this research influences your design. We've been talking about how this helps individuals. How does this change your field and how you think about it?
You know, so much of the outstanding landscape architecture design in the world today deals with this stuff and does it in a wonderful fashion. This new study about using your device offers a little bit of a challenge to landscape architects because with this new finding, it suggests that we're going to have to up our game a little bit and maybe find ways to create landscapes that are a little bit more fascinating, that draw people's attention away from their
or
phones.
Or jam devices.
Maybe. Well, the problem is nobody's...
Device-free zones.
Who's going to go to those landscapes is the challenge.
Right. So, and I wonder, do you find it a challenge to just leave your device behind?
Sometimes I do.
Even knowing this research?
Sometimes I do.
Brenda, what would you say to convince people that it's okay to just leave your device behind for a little bit and just enjoy where they're at?
Well, I would tell them to just notice being in the present moment without your device and just give it a chance and see how much more they notice when they're moving slowly without a device and just paying attention to the details of the moment, to the ephemeral moment that they're in. That would be my advice.
And that's also great advice if people don't have access to a certified forest therapy guide such as yourself. We actually found you through a statewide guide. So we will tweet out that link to different forest therapy guides that are available throughout the state of Illinois. But I want to thank Brenda Spitzer for being with us. She's a forest therapy guide, as I've been saying, at the Morton Arboretum in Lyle. Bill Sullivan has also been with us. He's the head of the Department of Landscape Architecture at the University of Illinois and one of the authors behind this research, which we will tweet out as well, which I will give you permission to read on your devices. Bill, thanks to Bill, Brenda, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Nyla.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's program, that does it for us today, but tomorrow we're going to continue our technology conversation by asking about digital tools that can make getting a job easier and finding candidates more convenient. But what are you losing when you eliminate the human touch? We're also going to get into why Illinois has one of the highest numbers of home foreclosures in the country, be focusing on those areas that have the most foreclosures. That's, stay tuned for tomorrow's program for that. You can always go to our website, 21stshow.org, to find more information, how to contact us if you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us at social media. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. We are a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have a great day. See you back here tomorrow.